back to the subject of the motives, with the cult motive of separating people from friends and family, I think that Bunting selected out Troy to kill because Jamie didn't want to kill him. Troy was selected by John Bunting.
Yeah.
I think he wanted Troy killed for multiple reasons, partially because he was very intelligent and Bunting liked everyone around him to be stupid and pliable, partially because he wasn't somebody who could be recruited as one of the killers. Possibly John Bunting thought that Troy was a paedophile, but also the motive of getting rid of the intelligent older brother so that Jamie again becomes more controllable. And that was something that surprised me in the book that I read on the case. Jamie claimed that John wanted to kill not just the older brother, Troy, but the younger brother as well, and that they were planning a double murder and that the mother was going to be going away to stay with some other family members and would leave the three kids there. And then John and his crew would get the boys, Troy, the older brother and the younger brother, kill them, leave Jamie alive, and then they were going to tell the mother that the two sons ran away together. But what happened in the end, according to the book, was that when Elizabeth, the mother, went away with the family, she took the youngest son with her. And according to Jamie, John was furious that he never got to kill the younger brother, who must have only been about 13. And that shows a horrific aspect of John Bunting, and that if that was true, then he was prepared to kill, probably torture as well, 13-year-old. I think he was 13, who had done nothing wrong to anybody. And the motive there would be because he enjoyed killing and torturing in itself, but also to sever Jamie from both of the other brothers.
Oh, blimey.
Yeah,
with the Troy thing, I think, in the film he's presented as standoffish with John, not really very interested in being taken under his wing.
You have that scene that establishes that point that Troy can't be controlled, in which John has sat around in the kitchen with a load of guests and he's doing his usual thing of casually talking about, oh, let's kill this paedophile.
Yeah.
Talking about ways of killing them. And Troy has stood there with his arms folded, staring at John like he's disgusted at this monster. And he's right. And John says to him, what the hell's the matter with you? And Troy just sort of casually walks out the room. And it's basically a way of telling John Bunting to, pardon my French, to fuck off. And that scene absolutely established that Troy was not able to be controlled by John. So that would make him a target for being killed. And maybe John felt his ego was bruised by the fact that he couldn't control Troy.
Yeah, like you said, it's just a massive conflagration of all these distorted motives and things. Yeah. Another thing this film does well is there's a real economy. I think we only really see Troy twice before he's killed. There's the trampoline scene, which is really short, but you can see he just can't get to him. Yeah. But one thing they did, which was really chilling, was when Troy is raping Jamie, which, as we said, may well not have happened in reality, you have the cricket commentary on the TV.
Right.
And having that on in its ordinariness just makes it more chilling. And then when Troy is killed, and we'll talk about that in a second, perhaps not for too long, because that's tough for even me to stomach. Yeah. When they kill Troy, he says, turn the TV on. And it's something about the fact that what's on the TV is so innocent. It just makes it even more chilling. I don't know.
Yeah, it makes for, it's part of the background casualness. I suppose the raping of Jamie, although as I mentioned, I disagree with showing Troy doing that because it wasn't established as fact.
Yeah.
At the same time, there did need to be a scene of that nature in the film because there was actually a lot of sexual abuse that went on. And it was, in a lot of these families in this community, and it was often systematic sexual abuse happening on a casual basis. Mm. So they got that in the film, and I think it did belong in there. They just did it with the wrong character. Having the cricket playing on the TV in the background, it's like the rape is just one of those daily activities, like watching the TV.
That's it, yeah. Because I remember listening to a war correspondent, probably BBC, I think, and he was watching tennis, Wimbledon, on the TV in his hotel room. I can't remember where he was. It may have been Bosnia. I can't remember. But basically, all the bombs started going off, and all this started going on. And, of course, the commentary of the tennis still carried on. It's really innocent. And, I don't know. That was just so effective for me. That was one of the things I thought really worked well.
That's funny, that.
Is there anything we need to say about the killing of Troy, apart from perhaps it's one of the most harrowing things we've ever seen on film? Is there anything about that other than the, you know, obviously the pure sadism of it?
About the scene itself or about the real case?
No, about the scene itself.
I mean, I'm not really saying anything original on this in this respect, but I think to be true to the case and to let the audience know just how awful these crimes were, you had to show something of the real killings. A reenactment of the real killings. To not have that in the film, I think, would be an absolute disservice to the story itself and arguably a disservice to the victims, because you just can't even imagine what these people went through when they died. And I think they showed enough in the film to establish that point. And that's one of the things that made the film grow on me a hell of a lot more, was after I read about the case. I sort of decided I didn't want to watch the film again, but I thought, well, I'm okay to read about the case. And then when I read about it and I found out that what they showed in the film was just nothing compared to what really happened, I thought, well, you know, they weren't being exploitative. I thought it was exploitative when I first saw it, a deliberate shock value, and then I realized that, no, it wasn't that. They could have been a lot more exploitative in how they filmed that.
They sanitized it.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, actually. There's a thing about that. I think probably the hardest thing to show audiences in terms of torture scenes, the aspect that people don't want on screen, is the screams of the victim. People who work on these cases, the thing that seems to mess them up the most, from what I've read, is when they have to hear the audio recordings that some killers have made of the victims and all the screams and stuff. And apparently, like, this, the real thing is just way worse than anything you ever hear in a movie.
Yeah.
But a very interesting thing what they did in the Snowtown is they got around the screaming thing by making it a choking torture. So you're visually seeing the torture, and the guy's all smashed up and his face is barely recognizable. And you know that he's suffering intensely with this repeated choking, but you can't hear him scream. Mm. You know? So I suspect that they deliberately showed that aspect of the torture to avoid having to really upset the audience with hearing the screams. And the fact that it would be very hard to get an actor to do the screams in the way that a real victim would.
Yeah, one of the chilling things, I don't want to go into too much detail, just to say, if anyone hadn't seen the film, it's fairly horrific. But again, like you said, without showing too much, they show you enough so you have some understanding. But basically, Jamie goes out because he doesn't want to watch it. And then again, they do this brilliant thing where you just see, I think you see a load of kids going past on a motorbike. You see a bunch of kids going past on bicycles. And you just see this total ordinariness. And of course, you can't hear, like you say, you can't hear Troy screaming when Jamie goes outside. And then John calls him back in, the TV's still on. And then when you cut back, you know, you can see Troy is an absolute mess, but he's totally pacified, you know? Yeah. And it has a weird kind of peace about it in a strange way. John's like putting his arm around Troy's head almost. But Troy is just like totally and utterly pacified.
Which is what John Bunting arguably wanted, because this was a kid who had defied his will, refused to be controlled, and clearly didn't agree with John's ideology or his activities. And so he wanted to neutralize that. And I would say that was probably his main aim in that particular killing.
And interestingly, the tape that Troy has to send, he actually, you know, has to say to his mama, "Oh, I fucking hate you," you know, which I don't think the other ones had done that. From memory, from watching it today, one of the other ones is like, "Oh, I've met someone, I'm moving away." With Troy, he actually gets him to say that he hates his mum.
I mean, in a way, that's like emotional torture of the mother. But they established that in the movie in quite an interesting way that I thought was quite powerful. After Troy has been killed and the mother has been told or has heard the message saying that her eldest son hates her and has run away from home and is never going to come back, and she's really upset about it. You see her sitting in the bath.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say.
The same bath where her son has been killed. Yeah. And it's like she is one of the victims in the bath, but it's a psychological torture, not a physical one. I thought that was a very powerful visual way of putting that across.
Yeah, it's great, yeah, because it's not... I feel like Hollywood might have done that in a bit of a clunky way, you know, too obvious.
Yeah.
But I clocked that immediately, yeah.
So I was going to mention, I didn't want to forget this point because you mentioned before about the playing of the TV really loud. Some torture murders would be done with the victim gagged so they can't scream. But in these murders, as far as I know, they weren't. I mean, Bunting liked the screams and he wanted the verbal dialogue with the person where they would order the person to say things. And there's a really weird aspect of it that showed up in the book is that, which is not shown in the film, but they made Troy call them by specific names. He had to call John, your lordship, master.
Oh, God.
You know, these stupid, almost comical names, but they would be long, difficult names to remember. And if he got it wrong, the torture would carry on because he wasn't delivering the right address of these people who were in control of him. But in terms of the TV, because they didn't want to gag the victim, they would blast music or have the TV really, really loud.
Mm.
So the neighbors would just hear TV or music, and they obviously wouldn't knock and try and tell John Bunting to be quiet, because you know how he'd respond. Another case that has some similarity in terms of the playing of loud music and the screams is the Toolbox Killers in the 1970s in America. That's a case that is just as horrific as the Snowtown murders. And, you know, these two guys, the killers, they would kill people in their van and they would blast music to drown out the screams. They didn't want to gag the victims because they liked the screams. So, again, that's a similar comparison. There's a lot of comparisons between Bunting's murders and the murders of the Toolbox Killers. One other aspect, which is in the book that I read on the subject, or it might have been in the court case, but Bunting, he would make audio recordings of the victim screaming and dying, and then he would use audio editing software, which was available sort of newish on the market at the time when these murders took place.
Yeah.
And he would edit his favorite songs with screams of the victims.
Oh, my God.
With the music, you know. And there was a song by a band called Live who were very popular.
Oh, yeah, I know those. Yeah, yeah.
Apparently they had a song that was about abuse and it had lyrics like something, you're never going to do this to me again or something like that. And that specific song was something that Bunting edited in the screams, and sometimes he would play that song to his victims.
Jesus.
Well, I mean, it's awful. But that establishes an interesting thing about how John perceived his victims. With a lot of serial killers, there's some specific person, some archetype person in their head who they hate and want to hurt and kill. Mm-hmm. It can be a specific person who's abused them in the past, and they may have exaggerated the abuse in their mind or they may not have. And then each time they kill someone, subconsciously in their mind, they are projecting the person who they really want to kill, which might be their abused mother or father or somebody else. And this is one of the things that makes me think there might be some credibility to John's story about having been raped when he was 8 years old. If he was playing a song like that, "You're never going to do this to me again," as he was torturing people, that suggests to me that he was playing out a fantasy of hurting and killing a person who had raped him. And all of these victims, on some level, represented that person.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, yeah. I think the projection thing, I mean, that's a core part of, I don't know, the sort of psychology of aberrant behavior, you know? People can justify these things if they project it onto somebody else. So that's a massive part of serial killers.
It's an interesting aspect of it in that, you know, when they say like these killers, they have the urge to kill again and again.
Hmm.
I think part of the reason why a lot of them have that is because they will commit a particular murder and symbolically it represents revenge against somebody else who might already be dead. That person isn't alive or available to go and kill. So they kill somebody else as a substitute, and initially it will make them feel better, but it doesn't take away the trauma that they originally experienced.
Mm.
And so I suspect that in their minds, that archetype of the tormentor who they wanted to kill returns, gradually comes back in the mind, and then they want to kill somebody else. They want they, so they keep repeatedly killing this abuser archetype in the mind who they can never get rid of. It's permanently there in the head.
Yeah, it's like an itch that you can't scratch, you know, that urge to kill, Same thing happened with Christie. Like I say, I'm a bit of an authority on Rillington Place, but he had a long period. In fact, we don't even know. There's a couple of murders in that case that are still actually quite disputed, but whether he killed them or not, he had a long break, But you can project all you want, but those things are not going to go away, unfortunately, are they? We're just going to go through the last act of the film. So as the director was describing it, as I was listening today, we get this sort of more trancey music, and Jamie is quite heavily into heroin. And I think he's just in a state where he's kind of checked out almost. I don't want to criticize the guy because I think he's really good, but do you feel like a professional actor might have been better for Jamie, or do you think they made the right choice?
I think so, yeah. I mean, Jamie in the film, I can't remember the actor's name who plays him, but...
Lucas Pitaway.
Yeah. I mean, basically, I assume this is more to do with the way his character is directed. He basically just goes around in the film just looking numb constantly from the very first appearance right to the very end. He has some crying scenes as well. He does have some strong scenes as an actor, I suppose, the crying scenes and so on. But I think that character could have been played a lot looser because there was a lot more to Jamie than just being this numb victim. Something that very much surprised me in reading the book about the case, which didn't match with the Jamie that I saw in the movie, was that during the court case, apparently Jamie was absolutely in tears talking about the crimes and everything. And I'm sure it was genuine. But on one day when he was being taken from the court, I think it might have been the first day that he was taken to or from the court, and all of press photographers were there, he was smiling and waving at the press photographers.
Wow.
It was like infamy, notoriety for these killings. And that seemed more like the type of behavior that Bunting himself would do.
Yeah.
And at this point, Jamie had already decided to be star witness. So what the hell was he doing, smiling and waving to the press? And it's things like that that make me suspect that Jamie was a hell of a lot more willing in these murders than he let on. And that he kind of selfishly just handed the other three for the chopping block to try and get himself off the hook. But, you know, the court didn't completely fall for that because they still gave him a life sentence anyway.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we can forgive the film a bit of artistic license, but what I was talking about really was watching it again, the only real criticism on the acting front, I didn't really see a big change in him. Like you said, he seemed to have the same expression on his face at the end of the film from the beginning. I didn't totally buy this brainwashed thing, which I'm sure happened in reality, like you said, up to a point. You know, he wasn't an innocent snowflake. Yeah. But yeah, there's one slight quibble with the acting.
It's in a way there's an aspect of the Jamie character that would have been difficult for any actor anyway, and that those events took place over 7 years or so, beginning from when he was like early teens, maybe 14 or something, and then by the time they were all caught and the court case happened, he was like maybe 20, 21. So they had to have the same actor play all of those ages in the role. And that he just comes across in the movie like he's the same age all the way through.
Yeah.
And that's a visual problem anyway. Maybe some changes of hairstyles and clothing and some makeup could have established him aging over the years. But it certainly didn't help that he had the exact same look on his face. I agree with you. That's the weakest actor performance in the film. And it stands out even more for the fact that Daniel Henshaw's performance is so amazing.
Yeah, I just didn't feel like there was much character arc there. But we'll just fast forward a little bit. Well, we get, as we mentioned earlier, Mark, one of the guys, Mark Hayden, he tells John that he's let it slip some stuff to his wife, and we kind of know what's going to happen after that. And again, John with that really sinister smile on his face, always says, "Don't worry about it, mate. You know, nothing will happen." It's pretty horrendous. And then we get the final killing. And I thought this was brilliantly done. I mean, this is his stepbrother, whose name is David.
Yeah.
So they lure him on the pretense of this cheap computer. This was the only killing, as you said earlier, that actually happened in Snowtown. The whole sort of long drawn out, I think it was a 2-hour drive. They go to the pub. And there were those were some good shots of Jamie looking at this guy, knowing what's about to happen. But the thing that I'd forgotten about, and I'd, was this reality or not? The director was saying that the idea is given that Jamie thinks that he might be killed by John. Again, I'm not sure that totally worked. What did you think about that?
Is that what he mentioned in the commentary?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. I wasn't getting that. And that, in fact, so I just want to say one thing. John actually starts to befriend one of Jamie's younger brothers. And the idea, again, that I didn't pick up on is that he's going to be groomed next. And that because Jamie's sort of defied him a little bit.
Yeah.
I didn't get that sense at all. Did you, that Jamie might get killed himself?
No. I got the sense that Jamie had a general fear that he might die because he'd seen these murders happen. And again, you talked about eating. This is a scene after Troy's death where the four of them are eating fast food, the four killers, and Jamie's just sitting there not touching the food, and the other three are just munching away. And, you know, on the one hand, that is kind of like Jamie's so traumatized he can't eat. But at the same time, it could be argued that he's not eating any more of the lies. Maybe he's getting ready to crack and spill the beans. But that didn't happen because he only spilled the beans because the police got to him. Again, I go back to the thing that I think Jamie was way more into these killings than the film makes out. I mean, he had all these opportunities to tell the police every single day for all those years that he was involved in those killings. He could have gone to the police.
Yeah.
Or he could have at least ran away somewhere. Told his mother, said, look, I'm killing people with this. John, can you please get me away? And she could have helped get him away. I think he wanted to stay there. I think he really admired John. And the book talks about that. He adored John as like a very strong father figure. And I think he was way more involved and willing with these killings than the film lets on. A subject that I wanted to talk about today, I think I mentioned it in the notes. What would have happened if they weren't caught? Obviously, the killings would have carried on. There would have been dozens more victims. They never would have stopped. It would have carried on. It would have carried on until John Bunting grew too old for it or just died natural causes. Or it would have carried on until he pissed off the other killers so much that one of them killed him or something like that. But it would have carried on for a lot longer. And Jamie would have stayed involved with those killings for a lot longer. I don't see any signs in the book or the court case stuff that indicates that Jamie was on his way to spilling the beans to the police. He was carrying on with it. He'd been involved for years. He was going to stay involved with it for years more. And God knows how many more people would have been killed and what level he would have been taking part in the murders. So as you can tell, my sympathy for Jamie Vlasakis is quite low.
Yeah, having read some stuff, yeah. Because he watches, that's the thing, you watch this film and, yeah, you generally, I don't know, feel sorry for him. Or you, perhaps that's one thing they could have developed better. Didn't get that sense that he was massively more involved than he had been earlier.
Yeah.
I'm not sure they totally pulled that off. I'm just going to say one thing about serial killers. What often happens is they go into what one true crime writer called a fugue state, which is this sort of confused state, and they stop covering their tracks. I mean, that happened with Christie, you know, he left Temerlington Place with six bodies on the premises, and he'd even stopped like parceling them up. He just left one in an alcove in a sitting position. It's just, so I don't know. Do they get tired of it? I mean, I hate to be too lighthearted about it, but do they?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is a very weird thing about the Snowtown murders was the fact that the bodies were kept in these barrels instead of being buried out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if John could go out and find kangaroos and kill them and bring them back to chop them up, he'd obviously take bodies out and bury them in the middle of nowhere. That's easy to do, I suppose. But he chose to keep these bodies in the barrels. And one of the things in the book that I read about it that was theorized was that it was keeping the bodies in the barrels and not having them actually buried was a further insult to the victims.
Right.
So we're not even going to give you the dignity of being buried in the ground. We're going to keep you in a barrel of acid forever. But in order to do that, they ran the massive risk that somebody would find the barrels, and that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, it varies with serial killers. Some of them just like taking risks. Some of them are ultra, like, control freaks.
At the same time, Bunting was very, very sophisticated at evading capture. He had all kinds of techniques for it. The phone calls between the killers themselves, phoning each other up, talking about who they're going to kill, how they're going to kill them. Bunting had devised a code word system. For example, if he said to somebody on the phone, so-and-so needs to go to the clinic. That meant torture and kill them. But I think once the police started listening to it, it became pretty obvious. I mean, take them to the clinic. I mean, that's, it's not the best coding, is it? You know, he thought he was being clever on that one, but he wasn't. I find it interesting wondering about John's level of intellect. I don't think he was as smart as he thought he was, but he was very creative and imaginative. You know, he had the willingness to carry out ideas that other people wouldn't consider carrying out. And that can often be mistaken for intelligence. I think I've mentioned this before on a video about Silence of the Lambs, and that a lot of serial killers seem to be really intelligent because they are willing to do extremely manipulative things that the rest of us, we wouldn't even let the thought enter our head, because it's just like, that's going to turn out bad, that's wrong, and so on. But if you remove a person's morals completely, it really expands a person's choices of what they can do. You know, I mean, a lot of us, our intellectual ability to manipulate the world is restricted by our morals. So it can make us seem less intelligent compared to a serial killer.
Wow, interesting. If we could just finish up the plot here. So we get this last killing. As you said, really, I think you said this earlier, didn't you, about the justifications, and it's in the most recent Snowtown video you did. Yeah, they start off with a moral crusade of some kind. Perhaps they tell themselves they've got that. I mean, the Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe, who English viewers will definitely have heard of, he said he got a message from God to wipe out prostitutes. So he starts killing prostitutes. And then, of course, he moves on to, I don't know, quote-unquote normal women. No, that's a wrong term. I'm going to cut that out. Non-prostitutes. So, yeah, you get this crusade, and then you may be telling yourself you're carrying on the crusade. But in the real case, what was John's justification for killing David? That he's a yuppie. Is that it?
Yeah, the yuppie thing, there was a sort of probably similar to Troy's murder. There's a scene shown where David insults John because David's got a job, going to be a mechanic or something. So he's got himself a trainee job. You know, he's going somewhere, and he's got some money in his pocket from his job. And, you know, he's got nice new clothes and stuff. And so he insults John about his cheap sandals that he's wearing. And John just sort of passes it off with a joke. But I think that scene was shown to establish the jealousy and rivalry aspect of Bunting's motive for wanting to kill him.
Right.
How dare he think he's above me? Bunting hated yuppies. You know, I think he did actually call him a yuppie. Yeah, so that was part of the motive. I think there's lots of different motives on John's part. If you go over all of the murders, and some motives show up in certain places and some show up in other places. But with that one being the last murder, as you say, yeah, the surface level moral justifications had really faded into obscurity. Mm. And then it just became, oh, this guy's a yuppie. He thinks he's better than me, so we'll kill him for that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, where does that end? You know, he could, someone steps on John's foot in the street.
Yeah, exactly.
He annoyed him, you know. What can we say? It's choosing the motive to fit the killing rather than the other way around, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. There was another case I wanted to mention. I think it was in the notes I sent you about the murder of Suzanne Capper here in Britain, which was around the same time that the Bulger killing happened.
Oh, yeah.
But the Suzanne Capper murder was briefly in the news media, and it was an awful crime, but it was overshadowed by the Bulger killing because the victim was 2 years old and the perpetrators were 10 years old.
Yeah.
But in the Suzanne Capper murder, this girl was tortured basically for a week and then driven out in a car to the middle of nowhere and set on fire to die. But she survived long enough that when she was found by the police, she named her victims and then she died. So they managed to catch, there was six perpetrators. And as far as I know, they'd never killed anyone before. But their reasons for killing her were just utterly pathetic. And this was on their first killing, as far as I know. There was something to do with one of them thought that she'd stolen a coat. And one of them thought that he'd contracted pubic lice from her. Oh, and that was it. I mean, obviously, those weren't the real motives. There was no doubt a hell of a lot more than that going on there. But yeah, those are the kinds of excuses that were given to the police. You know, it's like, my God. So yeah, at least with John Bunting, he started off by trying to kill actual real paedophiles. You know, I don't approve of the way he did it, But at least there was some sentiment of morality of some kind going on there. But yeah, as you say, it just faded off to the point where let's just kill someone because I feel like it. You know, at the end of the day, that was it. I just feel like dominating somebody, so I'll torture and kill them. And that was what he was all about in the end.
We won't go on this tangent now, but I think in your video, you even mentioned the war on terror and the idea. I mean, when that started, when 9/11 happened, I was quite involved in activism. I was paying much more attention than I do now, unfortunately. Mm. But it's the idea of, was there actually some ideological, even if it's a twisted ideology, you know, if you look at communism, Nazism, all those, was there actually a genuine ideology at work in a twisted mind? Or was that, were they willingly just using that as a smokescreen? I don't know.
Yeah, as in, is it fake from the beginning, fake motives from the beginning?
That's it.
I mean, I've worked in probation a little bit and met quite a lot of criminals in there, met paedophiles as well, and sat and talked to them, done a bit of key work with them. And so I got a little bit of familiarity about the attitudes of criminals to their own crimes. And as far as I can tell, virtually across the board, they persuade themselves that there's justifications for what they do. Mm. And there may even be a certain amount of genuine justification. They may have like a handful of motives, and it may be that one or two of their motives have some validity, like with John Bunting, protecting kids from paedophiles. That's a valid motive, you know? How he does that is, you know, what his way of achieving that is bad. But I think a hell of a lot of criminals have, at some level, something they want to achieve that does have some validity, or at least they persuade themselves at minimal that is the case. I think that's true of individuals. I think it's true of street gangs. You know, street gangs persuade themselves that, oh, it's us against the world. The world doesn't give a monkey's about us. Mm. So it's us against the world, and we've got to take what we are entitled to that the world won't give us. So, you know, they go out and commit all of their crimes and stuff, and they think that they're like the knights in shining armor fighting back against the system. But also, I think that happens with governments, with think tank groups, with political parties. I think it's very rare that any of them actually say to themselves, "Well, we're going to do something evil.
That's what
we're going to do something horrible. There's no good reason for us doing this, but we want to." Yeah. Because it achieves this selfish aim for us. So, you know, let's just go ahead and do it. I think it's very rare that criminals, either organized or individuals, have that kind of self-honesty. I think that they virtually always have false motives built into it. And they need to do that in order to function. You know, the best liars are the ones who can convince themselves well enough of a lie that they naturally express a belief and congruency in their own false motives, you know. It's hard to lie to somebody if you know fully consciously that you are lying when you lie.
Yeah, and you've got that pesky thing called empathy as well, haven't you? Stops us becoming trillionaires, because at some point we're not prepared to do those horrible things. But yeah, I'm sure, I don't know if it's a famous quote or I read it in a psychology book or something, that humans can do anything if they can justify it to themselves. So that's where they have to start. Oh, yeah. You know, we've all had that, hopefully in small ways, you know, not doing really awful things, but we've all done, I'm sure, little Absolutely. Things that we're not proud of because we managed to convince ourselves and we said, right, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for me, that's one of the most important lessons from this Snowtown case. And I mean, there's a lot of interesting things to be learned from this case, a lot of social lessons that we can learn as individuals and learn about society itself. But yeah, I mean, this is such a clear case of how human beings can so severely distort reality and create false motives in order to justify the most horrific behaviors and actually persuade themselves that they are the good guy and that they're doing something that is helping the world and that the victims deserve it. This is like, for me, one of the ultimate examples of that mentality. And it makes me ask the question of both myself and other people around me, if these people could persuade themselves to do these horrific behaviors and persuade themselves that it was totally justified, what kinds of things can I persuade myself to do? Things that are nowhere as evil as what they've done, but it would be so much easier to justify any other behavior besides what they've done, you know? So I think it's an important lesson for everybody. Be careful with your justifications. Look at what you're doing for what it is in itself without the justifications. Am I doing things that hurt other people? And is that right in itself? You know, is what I'm doing bad in itself? Yeah, that's the best way I can put it at the moment. We all need to look at that and be careful about false justifications.
Well, I think one of the attractions of film is that if you really think about it, we are constantly creating narratives, you know, our view of the world, because it's so subjective, of course. We're constantly telling ourselves narratives. So that's where things like, you know, confirmation bias, you know, I mean, that's everywhere on the internet now. You know, if you're a liberal, or I know you don't like those terms. I've seen that video as well. I'm totally with you.
Each side accuses the other of confirmation bias. Yeah,
exactly.
Ironically, confirmation bias has become in itself a justification for false motive.
Well, it's almost become like a political position.
Yeah.
But yeah, confirmation bias, for anyone who doesn't know, it's the idea, yeah, you have some ingrained idea, and then as soon as you get one example, it's like if you get in your head that all Germans are kind of very efficient but lacking in humanity or something like that. Yeah. If you meet one who you find is a bit like that, that will say, oh, yeah, I was right all along. So that's a huge thing now, you know.
But also the issue of you selectively ignore counter evidence.
Yeah.
And there's usually plenty of that evidence out there, but you just choose not to pay attention to it.
Absolutely, yeah. Right. I just want to talk just briefly about the deleted scenes. I mean, if you've got any that you specifically want to talk about, go for it. The ones I wanted to talk about was there's actually two characters in the deleted scenes that we don't see in the entire film. Am I absolutely right about that? Michael and Nadine.
I've seen the deleted scenes, but my memories are vague. I haven't got like a list of them. So go ahead.
Well, I'll just describe one, in fact. So they have these two characters called Michael and Nadine, and I'm pretty sure in the final film you don't see anything of them. Michael is a very flamboyant character. So you see them at a party and Michael dresses up to look very effeminate. Okay. And then the Nadine character is a little bit older than Jamie, and it's essentially more or less his first crush, and nothing actually happens. They have a brief kiss, but she's obviously much more worldly and she stands up to John as well. I don't want to second guess the director, but I guess they left those out because it really does change the film. I mean, suddenly you've got Jamie dealing with like first romance, you know, and if you think about it, to me, that would seem a bit out of place. And then there's a scene where they go to the beach and you've almost got like a bromance going on with John and Jamie. But it was interesting. They had those two characters that they completely left out. Perhaps we just didn't need any more subplots. What do you think?
Well, the young lad, Michael, who sort of dances around in women's clothing, if I remember rightly.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, he was one of the victims in the real case. I think he was one of the youngest. He might have only been about 17 years old. And his murder was one of the most horrific of them all, one of the most prolonged. And he was targeted for no other reason than he was gay, because John believed that gay men were paedophiles by nature. So, you know, he sees this late teenage gay lad and he instantly thinks, I'm going to have to kill him because he's going to be a paedophile, you know. So I can't remember what the reason was given for leaving that scene out.
I mean, I feel like the Gavin character, you know, the one that got him into drugs, his friend earlier in the film, I feel like maybe that bit was already taken care of with that character.
Yeah.
So it would have had a bit of repetition. So you've got another guy who Jamie seems to like and you've got to wipe him out kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, actually, Barry Lane is a cross-dresser, isn't he?
Yeah.
And they kill him. So I suppose that murder in itself and the fact that John makes it clear in certain scenes that he detests Barry. And I think it comes across that he detests him not just because he's a paedophile, because the real Barry Lane is a lot less sympathetic than the one in the film. He was a horrible man. He was a paedophile. He was abusive to Robert Wagner.
Yeah.
And he was very manipulative. And apparently was jealous of the guy who was abusing Elizabeth's children. And that's why he went and told her that her kids were being abused by this guy, because he was jealous that it wasn't him doing the abusing. And he'd done time for sex crimes against kids as well. So yeah. He was not a nice guy at all, but they painted him a lot more sympathetically in the film.
But is he actually a paedophile in the film? I thought it was more like a paedophile spotter, isn't he, really?
Yeah, that's what they put him across yeah. as. And you do put across the point in the film that John Bunting uses him to identify other paedophiles. And that's on the assumption that Barry Lane was actually telling the truth and had his facts straight about who was a paedophile or not. And they did establish a little bit of that in the film, and that Barry mentions a specific person of a name who Barry wants to be a victim.
Oh, yeah.
Barry's admitting that he had a relationship with this guy, and at the same time he's saying this guy's a paedophile, needs to be killed. To me, it came across clear in that scene that Barry was lying that the guy was a paedophile. Or if he was, he wasn't revealing him as a paedophile because he had a moral obligation. He was doing it because he had a personal beef with the guy because he was an ex-relationship, like an ex-boyfriend he was pissed off with. And so he basically decided he wanted to set John onto the guy and have him tortured and killed. And he actually says in the scene, "I want in on him." In other words, he wants to take part in the murder.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
I don't know if they made that up for the film, but at least it showed that there was a very nasty side to Barry Lane.
There's a deleted scene where they show that Barry Lane was in a relationship with Robert Wagner. I'm pretty sure in the finished film, you don't get that at all.
That's an important scene, that, because it establishes the sense of victimhood of Robert Wagner, because he isn't really explored much in the movie. So I thought that was a very important scene for him. It gave him a motive for being involved in these killings, because he just comes across as just completely robotic. I mean, he looks cold, the actor, but they don't give much background to his character. So I think that scene should have been left in.
I guess because I read up on the case after seeing the film. I think there's already quite a bit of work for the audience to do during the film to work out what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, obviously we know the main stuff that's going on, but all those characters. So I think they did a good job in the end.
The thing you mentioned about Jamie, I suspect the filmmakers had a good understanding of this case, and I don't think they were as naive about Jamie as the film portrays. If I remember rightly, they were talking in some of their interviews, or it might have been the commentary, that they needed, for the story to be told, they needed some sort of protagonist. So they selected Jamie because he was part of the killings. So they needed to have a character through which the story and the murders could slowly be revealed to the audience. Mm. So Jamie was selected for that purpose. So I think they deliberately gave Jamie a great deal of innocence at the beginning of the film, so that his journey of discovery of these horrors would be our journey.
Mm.
So I suppose the cost of that is that it didn't present the real Jamie case with accuracy.
Yeah, the director said something weird. They even planned towards the end that they would have Jamie look at the camera in one scene at the very end, almost to tell the audience, sort of increasing our kinship with him. Right? We need a protagonist, so it may as well be him. And then the very, very last scene, which is that amazing part, which I think it's in slow motion, isn't it, when he closes the door of the bank vault. He's kind of closing the door on the audience as well. Is that I'm no longer one of you. I mean, that might be speculative, but if it's the director of the actual film, then I'll give him some leeway, you know.
Yeah, I think you're right on that, yeah. It sounds about right.
Yeah.
I mean, personally, I had funny feelings about the ending, and I still have, because it's not the end of everything that happened. There was the court case and everything that came afterwards, but then you could easily tag on another hour or two of movie for that. The film almost ends as if John Bunting wins. You know, he gets to kill all these people. Nothing bad happens to him. And there isn't really a sense of, for me, there wasn't a closure in terms of the murders coming to an end.
Mm.
That's just thrown together in the captions after the final murder. It's just, oh, they were arrested and there was a trial and they went to prison. You know, I thought that there needed to be something else on the end there to expand that and show that there was a bad ending for all of them, really. But I mean, that's not to take away from what is there in the film. It's just something extra that I think would have helped the film a bit more. And maybe it's part of what made the film less successful, because what you see in the film and that the scenario is so horrific in itself. I think the audience needed to come away with some sense of closure that there is a little bit of justice in the world. It's not all just horrific, you know.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I'm kind of thinking I want to end this podcast with something hopeful. So hope you got something up your sleeve, but yeah.
Well, you just tell me when it's time to end, and I'll try and think something up.
I mean, I'd love to go on and on, but I'm flagging a bit. I've had a long day. I don't know. One difficult thing is, would we recommend this film, and who would we recommend it to?
Tricky. I think I'd recommend it to anybody who's interested in psychology. I'd recommend it to anybody who's interested in true crime.
Yeah.
I wouldn't recommend it to anybody who just wants a couple of hours of casual escapism.
Yeah.
But you don't watch this film for that.
There's other films you could...
Yeah, you don't come away from this film feeling better than you were when you started watching it.
No, you just feel highly traumatized for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
But, also, maybe filmmakers as well. I mean, I have a English student who's a filmmaker, and I sent this to him, and he was impressed by it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, everybody I've recommended to who's actually gone and watched it, because some people I've warned them, I've said, only watch it if you think you can handle. You know, I've given them rough basics, and some people have said, I'll give that a miss and not watch it. But pretty much everybody else who I've recommended it to has come back and said, wow, okay, that was a good movie. And whether they said they never ever want to watch it again, they were still glad that they did, and they always praised it. Yeah, so
I'd say watch it during the day, perhaps.
yeah, don't.
I hate
don't
telling watch. People how to watch films, but you know.
Yeah, I've always said that to people as well. Don't watch it right at night before you go to bed, especially not on your own.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Any final thoughts? I mean, we're recommending this film, as we said. But...
Okay, I'm just going to very quick glance over the notes here, because I know a lot of things we did cover.
Yeah, we tried to cover as many as possible, but there's just so much in this, isn't it? It's amazing.
I'll give you a very quick list here. You've seen the list anyway, but I'll just reel them off without going on too much. In terms of the complexity of the motives that were involved in all of these murders, the list I've got is the paranoia of paedophiles being everywhere when there actually wasn't nearly as many as they thought. So paranoia was a big aspect of it, almost conspiracy theory, you know, in the classic, if you use that classic term, that was their version of a really dangerous conspiracy theory. The second one we've already talked about, which is symbolic revenge, where there's when they're killing somebody, they're actually in their mind, they're killing somebody else who they want to kill, who was a past abuser. I think we mentioned earlier white knight syndrome, the ego of perceiving themselves as crusaders for the common good, basically doing the job that they thought the police should be doing.
Yes, that's another aspect, yeah.
And the domination and humiliation was a major factor. Humiliation is a very powerful tool for psychologically controlling and dominating other people. And they use that a lot. A lot of the torture routines, the psychological aspects are about humiliation. We haven't talked about the financial welfare benefits thing, where they were killing people and then claiming the welfare benefits for the dead people. So there was, you know, they were making money from it. And then basic bigotry towards gays, drug addicts, and one of the victims they killed was mentally disabled as well.
Oh, yeah.
They just had a lot of hatred for a lot of groups. And John Bunting had a history where I think he and Robert Wagner joined like a sort of neo-Nazi type group, but they were so extreme in the views that the group kicked them out.
Oh, my God.
And then the bigotry, the class system bigotry towards yuppies. I mean, the class system is a big part of this. With the where they came from, but we've already talked about that. And then the basic excitement, the adrenaline of torturing people. I mean, it would be a very intense experience. If it was something you enjoyed, it would probably be the most intense thing you could have. Yeah. And then petty revenge, you know, for people who've done things that they didn't like. Another one, possible brain damage or brain defect on John Bunting, where he had no sense of smell. He couldn't even smell the dead bodies and the bodies in the barrels. And apparently everybody else was just vomiting when, you know, because it was smelled so awful, but he couldn't smell it. And so, you know, there's been certain research studies that have been done where some psychopaths apparently don't have hardly any sense of smell. Or a person can have an injury to the brain that knocks out the sense of smell and also knocks out their emotional control center and reduces their empathy and makes them prone to tantrums and stuff like that. Wow. So that's a weird one. But the other killers in the case didn't have that. It was only John. And then some serial killers have severe bumps on the head when they're children, like Gary Hardnick. But I don't think that happened with John that I'm aware of. And then on the class system aspect of it, the multi-generational poverty and poor parenting, massive thing with the killers and the victims and everybody in the neighborhood. The pathological hatred of authority, the police, total distrust of the police, believing that the police were protecting paedophiles. And funnily enough, we've got a lot of conspiracy stuff going on in the world today where people in high positions are being accused of rape things and paedophile things. And you've got like, and sometimes it's true, you know, you've got proven cases with Gary Glitter and it was the other big one we had here. I can't remember.
Jimmy Savile. Jimmy Savile, of course.
We've all heard of multiple cases like that. And it's not just individuals. Sometimes you get groups of people like the guy in America. my memory of names is just gone to pot.
Don't worry.
The guy who killed himself in prison. Who was that?
Jeffrey Epstein.
So I mean, we have these real world examples of people in authority positions who are rapists and paedophiles, and the hatred of authority and distrust of police that was there in this case from these killers. So they felt they were doing the police's job, but also in South Australia. There has been an ongoing controversy over something called the family murders, which is apparently a high-level group of torture murderers who are politicians, high-level lawyers, people in very powerful positions in South Australia. And there's been persistent rumours that have had a lot of media coverage for decades. John Bunting must have been aware of the rumours of the family murders, because his killings took place in that part of the world. So again, that would add more to the hatred and distrust of authority, to the point where people weren't reporting to the police. And people in the community, some of them knew that these murders were happening and didn't report to the police, either because they didn't trust the police or because they agreed with the murders being paedophiles being killed. Wow. So yeah, that's a complex, weird one. And here in Liverpool, I mentioned this briefly, I'm aware of a case with a serial rapist called Matthew Byrne, who was the director of the Young People's Advisory Service here in Liverpool, a big stocky guy with red hair. And he got arrested maybe 15 years ago because he was taking pictures of children on the train. So he got arrested and they looked on his phone and they found that he was into, you know, taking pictures of everybody's kids. So they checked his home. They went to his house and his house was kitted out like a dungeon. A newspaper article went out saying that he'd been arrested and was being charged for child porn and stuff like that. Mm. And I knew a lot about this case because one of the other people he worked with in his office also was doing night shifts with me in a hostel. And so that person was telling me a lot of details about the case that weren't made public. And Matthew Byrne, after the newspaper article went out about him, loads of prostitute women from Leeds and places like that came forward and said, "That's the guy who raped and beat me up years ago." So it turned out he was a serial rapist. He would persuade prostitutes to go back to his place and then they'd be there. And then suddenly somehow they'd be knocked out, whether it was from a drink or whatever. And then he dumped them in the middle of nowhere, just black and blue, absolutely battered. But on the surface level, he was for the common good. He was a Young People's Advisory Service. There was all articles online with him talking about saving the atmosphere, green policies. And there was a photo of him shaking hands with David Cameron.
Wow.
That's not to say that David Cameron knew who he was shaking hands with. But, you know, this guy moved in high circles and he was also a board member of Common Purpose in Liverpool, which is a leadership training organization which operates around the country. And he even fooled them. And he was a candidate for the Liberal Democrats to be an MP while these rapes were going on. So, I mean, this kind of paranoia that you get from Bunting and so on about, paedophiles everywhere and stuff, there are some real world justifications for those paranoias, you know.
Yeah.
And, almost at the end of the list, Dave.
Okay.
do you want me to finish now, or there's a couple of other things?
No, a couple more.
Okay. One of them about this case and similar things is that actually fantasies of torture and murder are actually a common thing. It's just that the vast majority of people don't bring it into consciousness and don't act upon it. Mm. And it's present in the language that we use. If someone's annoyed at someone, they say, "Oh, I could kill him. And that's because deep down there is subconsciously a representation of actually killing that person. The desire to inflict pain and murder is actually something that I think exists in us all on some level. Yeah, there's a handful of other things, but I won't go into them because none of them are major things, I don't think.
Okay.
Some of these are already covered. Yeah, so yeah, I think that's about it.
I suppose, like, to leave some sort of message is to say, from everything you've said there, is that human beings are inordinately complex, and that, you know, it's hard for people not to. If I said to someone, "Oh, don't judge John Bunting or whatever," without knowing the story, it's hard for people. I understand that.
Yeah.
You know, and in the end, you know, as we said before, we need a justice system. You can't just let people off because they've had difficult times. But, you know, just to say that I tend to agree with you. I think it's in, not saying those kind of acts are in everyone, but something, you know, we probably do have a killer instinct in there somewhere.
Yeah. I suppose one admission that I could give is that I couldn't care less if John Bunting was executed for his crimes. You know, right. So that's a killer instinct in me. And if somebody said they were going to kill him in a nasty way, like I were going to burn him at the stake, I wouldn't be raising voice and objection, yeah. Ironically.
Yeah, I know, I get it.
I'm also making that point because I don't want anybody to think out there that I'm trying to persuade people to have sympathy for Bunting. I think it's worth studying his background and his beliefs to try and figure out why he did the things that he did. I'm interested in it on that level, but I'm not interested in it for saying, oh, poor John, because as far as I'm concerned, he is responsible for his actions. And, you know, whatever punishment comes to him, that's the way it is.
All right. Hey, listen, this has been amazing. We could go on longer, but I think we've covered, we've done a decent job of covering this.
We've covered a lot of good stuff. You had a lot of great questions there and stuff, and a lot of observations about the deleted scenes and so on. Yeah.
Yeah. Just tell everyone where they can find your work online.
Yeah, it's Collative Learning, COLLATIVE. Or if you just do a search online for Rob Ager, AGER, and my website will come up, and my YouTube channels will come up, so you can watch my videos on there, or go to the site where you can get the videos or the articles.
And you've actually got three YouTube. Yeah, you've got Rob Ager, Collative Learning, and Ager Bytes. Are you still adding to that?
I've been posting a lot of bits and pieces on there this past week because I'd ignored that channel quite a lot for a while, so right. I figured it was time to get some snippets on there. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's Bytes, BYTES. Yeah. All right, lovely. Thank you very much. And can you just stay on the line for a sec? Just have a 2-minute chat. All right, good luck with everything. Keep up the prodigious work rate, and maybe we'll speak in the future.
Thanks.
All the best.